I'm talking today about the NAACP's second century in the context of its first. I'll be talking about its organizational, economic, demographic, and philosophical challenges. And let me join the chorus of other participants and say how happy I am to have been invited, and also to convey my congratulations to Deborah McDowell and her staff and faculty for having conceived of this event. It's the many words that have been used to describe it, none of them are sufficient. It's really a wonderful occasion. It's an example of the imagined community precipitated by an organization like the NAACP. So my goal is to relate to some of the work I've been doing over a long period of time on civil rights organizations and their involvement in voting rights politics. In the process of doing that work, I, of course, knew of the NAACP, but began to look, as others have done, at its archives, the collection in the papers in the Library of Congress, and was struck in awe of them, of course. I'm not an historian, I'm a political scientist. I don't have the skills of the historians, but I've looked at some portions of the papers and have will draw on them for the work that is still to come. I'll make some reference to them today. We've heard from Julian Bond, who's led the NAACP board for 1/10 of the organization's history, and from Benjamin Jealous after his first year and leadership of the organization for 1/100th of its lifetime. I argue today that many of the issues Benjamin Jealous confronts are very much related to the organization's foundations and evolution during the 20th century. Many of the problems of the association are not new. They are old and are fundamentally connected to the status of African Americans in the United States. These are what I'm calling the organizational, economic, and philosophical challenges. Some of the problems are new and are challenging the association to reinvent itself. And we've seen from the speech by Julian Bond last night, by the conversation between Bond and Jealous, and Jealous's remarks to us before that, that they are already well along in that process. These are some of the reinvention, and some of the new problems are what I'm calling or pointing to are the demographic challenges. So I talk first about what I'm calling today philosophical challenges. And I treat the conceptualization of the membership of the NAACP as under the rubric of political philosophy, and I'm hoping this will be clear, but it may not be. And I should say that when I talk about membership, I've generally written this to focus on individuals, but the previous panel this morning made it clear that the constituencies of the association are not only individuals, they're also organizations and other cohorts of people in the American political environment. That throws interesting challenges into the mix as well. But let's go back to my individual membership concept. The NAACP includes, by definition, everyone who at the time of its founding was colored, which puts it into the category political scientists identify as a collective organization. These are the bodies that have responsibility for representing the interests of all members of a group, rich, poor, educated or not, sane or not, religious or not. You get the picture. Some ethnic organizations may select more specialized components of its group. For example, the Japanese American Citizenship League was formed in the era of the internment camps to suggest its loyalty to the American state and to deflect the stigma associated with being Japanese in wartime. The League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC today, was created specifically to mobilize those Mexican Americans who already held citizenship. Some organizations may focus on more specialized sectors of a racial or ethnic group, and we heard Julian Bond describe the vast array of new homogeneous organizations created by blacks in the wake of the successful civil rights era. The academics in the room belong to a number of newly created types of specialized black academic associations. I belong to the National Conference of Black Political Scientists. There are some members of the Association of Black Women Historians here. Some examples of old ones, the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, founded by the Institute's namesake, Carter G. Woodson, at a point when segregation permitted no no more specialized types of organization. The NAACP set as its responsibility the needs of all blacks, that is, their collective interests. I've called, in other work, the core of these collective interests the collective goods of citizenship. Attempting to achieve citizenship status when blacks were literally excluded from the political system was and remains a challenge of enormous complexity. The presentations that we've been hearing in the last days, the work by Patricia Sullivan, her description of the work that the lawyers were doing, gets at it. And it doesn't really matter how many different directions you try to come at it. It's very hard to capture the extent of that complexity. It has, I have argued, required African Americans to invent their own conception of equality outside of the boundaries of the American polity, but inside the internal space of the imagined African American community. The NAACP, its organization, the Legal Defense Fund, of course no longer part of it, but originally so, are part of that process of creating a space within which the state of citizenship for African Americans could be crafted. We began to talk yesterday about reparations. There's a relatively new book published by a political scientist at MIT, Melissa Nobles. That book is called The Politics of Official Apologies. That work explores, compares, and analyzes many cases of official governmental apologies, focusing on certain types of cases. And I'll read her quote of how she characterizes them, and it's an interesting bit of language. Those of indigenous peoples in Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and the United States, and of African Americans. That's a quote. So you see the countries, but then also of African Americans are part of that. Nobles has framed a meticulously developed argument, another quote. The theoretical claim is that political actors use official apologies in ongoing efforts to reshape the meanings and terms of national membership. The acknowledgement of historic injustices, which an apology announces, is directly tied to apology-altering membership, end quote, and to altering membership in the polity. So while not all apologies have involved reparations in the material sense, her focus on what she calls a membership theory of apology means that the apology itself may, by that process, recreate the polity. She makes no claims for reparations in the American context. So I'm arguing the NAACP operated within the American political framework, although its work had international impact. Laying out a strategy for addressing the citizenship status of an excluded group using a collective strategy is therefore one of the more challenging efforts at altering membership. They had no international groups to which to appeal. They were simply doing it within this American context. So that's the discussion of the philosophical issues, and obviously there's more, but 20 minutes. Organizational issues. They've had to manage in what is a national framework with the scarcity of resources that every presenter has emphasized. The NAACP's branches are now all over the country. How do you create an organization that can specialize and focus, but is national, and where the constituencies at that local level are not able to focus, are not able to aggregate information at the national level, don't have the capacity to organize information for comparative purposes, for example. We've been blessed in recent decades by the work of Alden Morris, Charles Payne, Barbara Ransby's research on the activists, especially and increasingly on Ella Baker's work, and her many organizational lives in the 20th century movements, including the NAACP in many roles and at many levels. She also focused on the tensions and the varying views of the structure of the NAACP and of other civil rights organizations. In the 1940s, Baker was assistant field secretary and eventually vice president for membership in the 1940s. And I'm going to read from some of Payne's work, who describes her highly critical views of the association even in those years, in which Pat Sullivan just talked about her as being actively involved, but she was also being critical at the same time. So this is Charles Payne, the sociologist. From her perspective, the national organization was victimized by its own success. The legal strategy had to be directed by lawyers and other professionals, leaving most of the huge mass base of the NAACP, 400,000 members by 1944, little meaningful role in the development of policy and programs, except raising funds and cheering victories as they came. She thought the program was overly oriented to a middle-class agenda and not nearly strong enough on the kinds of economic issues that meant most to working-class black people, some of the things we've been hearing people talk about. Perhaps above all, she found the organization too centralized, too many decisions were being made in New York. Now, I have not included a discussion of some of the organizational inventions that the NAACP engaged in. Pat Sullivan's work concluded on that point about the inventions of the lawyers, their ability to work in the field. That work, I can't emphasize how much that was a brilliant addition to organizational life in America, that we've seen many other groups use the form that was created by the NAACP and reproduce it to represent Puerto Ricans, women, gays, many other racial and ethnic groups, and it's a dominant litigated structure that has reshaped the way in which people conduct litigation. We don't necessarily hear of some of the NAACP's success as being the creation and invention of organizations. That is one of the things that I'm arguing that it does. I'm going to go on to talk briefly about the economic element. There wasn't enough money, of course. So black organizations, the branches, had to rely on a resource mobilization structure, meaning social mobilization, using collective action, using social, religious, professional organizations more cohesively than had been typical outside of subordinated racial group politics. In other words, when you look at the literature on American interest groups, the assumption, at least by the 1970s on the part of the economists who began to influence the political scientists, was that the specialized groups, the more economically organized groups, would be the ones that would be successful at influencing public policy. The idea that you'd have a collectively oriented political organization or interest group focusing on the breadth of a group as opposed to a narrowly focused group is counter to what most of that literature argues. Julian Bond's summary of the, and I quote, hundreds of new black single-purpose organizations, unquote, he listed last evening, is evidence of genuine change in the African-American interest arena, that it was even possible to have those groups by the, let's say, the 1970s, is symptomatic of the change. The civil rights movement made it possible for African-Americans to specialize in specific economic areas, what the economists call homogeneous economic organizations. The NAACP represents a heterogeneous organization that represented and represents, present tense I'm saying, blacks as a group. In some ways, its power rests in the ability of the association to move across many different dimensions of politics and economic status. It's also its weakness, since it's collective, meaning that its goals are for the group as a whole, and as Bond said last evening, we believe that colored people come in all colors, so that it's now broadened its coverage well beyond African Americans. Add rather than subtract. My understanding of what the association would be doing, and assumed it before coming to the conference, was that it would reach out to the interests of other groups in the areas in which they function. So these are the old challenges. They've satisfied, once again, trying to read these notes, large group mobilization, I should say satisfied large group mobilization, involved it, invented the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, focused its efforts over time, and it overcame many impediments through extreme effort, very, very hard work by relatively small numbers of people, but didn't completely solve the problems, of course, is the point I want to make. New challenges include the demographic change. In some ways, the NAACP was advantaged in the core of the 20th century because it was able to focus on blacks. The American political environment was not especially complicated demographically, because European immigration had been cut off, because Asian immigration had been shut down in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The Latino population could not immigrate legally. So in a sense, as the century evolved, the country proportionally got relatively whiter. The immigrants who'd come from Europe were socialized to be more oriented towards the WASP norm of what America was. So in the late 20th century, at the same time as the 1965 Voting Rights Act was enacted, the Congress also passed major immigration laws. One of the elements of considerable importance to the NAACP that is accelerated by the 21st century is the increasingly complicated demographic environment with new racial and ethnic groups, each of which has its own group economic, philosophical, political, legal issues. These groups do not always recognize their indebtedness to the African Americans or to the NAACP, although in some cases they do. Somewhere in my files I have a poster from when I was at the University of Illinois of a student Asian American group that was titled, "Where Are the Asian American Malcolm X's?" I just couldn't ever throw that out. It was perfect. Or is that the example I've already given, this succession of legal defense funds created and modeled on the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. This area seems to me to be important in terms of how that shifts policy, that is, the creation of a more complicated racial and ethnic political environment. First, how will the NAACP respond to the needs of these new constituencies? It could ignore them and define their needs as outside the boundaries of interest, or it could respond. In more cases than not, I think it does. And this was said before, hearing the Bond and the Jealous presentations, which suggests that it is responding and in opening rather than narrowing and not acting defensively. The second follows. It's important in how the association creates possibilities for new constituents. Does it seek to make them allies? Does it seek to compete with them? But then the third issue is how it organizes itself strategically to deal with the requirements of these changed environments. And we've seen some evidence of that from the discussions we've heard today. I'm going to try to get to the end here. So recognizing the NAACP, for me as a political scientist, the work I've been trying to do has been to focus on that philosophical issues. So one of the things I try to say about this, there are clearly multiple levels of complexity associated with dealing with the status of African Americans that the NAACP has been able to handle. Those multiple levels of complexity have required the organization to solve a variety of basic, that is, theoretically complex, theoretically difficult organizational problems, to address complicated strategic questions, and to solve them while the problems of the racial group are itself still alive and well. And they've been able to do some of that. The role of the NAACP as it's defined it throughout its history is to be responsive to the broadest possible range of concerns of African Americans as a group, and now we see as people of color and discriminated people in general. But the NAACP represents a group that is shaped by economic dimensions, reclass in subtle ways, by complicated issues, cultural issues never fully resolved because of the denigrated status of African Americans. And let me tell you that if you read today's local paper, right after the end of the article on this conference, there's a small article that suggests that, namely a rap by four teenagers at a McDonald's in American Fork, Utah, meant that as they were trying to rap their request for food, they were charged with rapping and were eventually pursued by the police and arrested for that because they were rapping their request. Cultural differences. You know, you're like, what is she talking about? Read the article. It's unbelievable. So these are deep and complicated issues of which blacks can't entirely be free. One could argue, therefore, that it would be quite surprising if the NAACP weren't influenced by these markers of class and social status. Yet, I'm going to end with Claudrina Howard's point points in her presentation on the very vital role the NAACP played in employment in Charleston, South Carolina, Key West, Florida, among working class blacks and Bohemians in a number of settings in the 1920s. So, as a national organization, I'm arguing the NAACP is kind of a national congress. The work of the association in terms of that correspondence in the Library of Congress archives, their response to the branches, in a sense, you know, members of Congress respond to their constituents. Constituency service is the category that we use to describe it. In effect, the NAACP is actually a national congress for blacks, doing the constituency works for blacks all over the country and addressing their problems. The problems weren't necessarily solved, but they represent important ongoing tensions within the black population that no one else was willing to take on. So I'm going to stop just in case.